Welcome to Talking Up Music Education, a podcast from the NAMM Foundation. Talking Up Music Education podcast shares news and stories about music education from teachers, students, parents, school, and community leaders who care about music education and are working to create more opportunities for music learning. And now, here's your host, Mary Lurson.
Hi, everyone. This is Mary Lurson, Executive Director of the NAMM Foundation, and welcome to Facebook Live and this episode of Talking at Music Education, a podcast of the NAMM Foundation. We're here live at the NAMM Show here in Anaheim, California, and I'm just thrilled to welcome my guest, Eric Whitaker.
Thanks, Mary.
And here we are. Everybody. Here we are hosting Weekend Update. From the, we were having a little fun getting ready. This day two of the NAMM Show, Eric's just rolled into town, and we're here to get ready for something really exciting. Tell us what's happening tomorrow morning.
It'll be beautiful. So I guess we'll have 500-600 fellow choir geeks and attendees in the room with us.
At the NAMM Foundation Grand Rally for Music Education.
That's it, at the Grand Rally. And I'll have on stage with me the Riverside City College, this fantastic choir that I've worked with many times. And we'll do Cloudburst and Virtual Choir 4, Fly to Paradise. We'll perform those live and include the audience in it. It should be pretty stunning. And then I'll talk for 10, 15 minutes about the virtual choir and its impact.
Yeah, so we're just thrilled to have you here.
Thank you.
You know, I mean, the word got out that you were going to be our special musical artist guest for Grand Rally. And, you know, we tapped the virtual choral unconsciousness of hundreds of NAMM members and NAMM show attendees. So it's going to be very exciting.
Isn't it amazing that there's just this group, this huge community worldwide of people who just want to sing? They get incredibly excited about singing, right? And mm-hmm. and like you say about somehow tapping into that, most of the time it just stays quiet and under the surface. I think people do it in their community choirs, their church choirs, or school choirs. But given the chance,
tip them right into the
into
their deepest desire, or one, not the deep desire, even just the natural desire.
That's it. They come to life. And I think it's because singing is just so good.
Yeah. So through the NAMM Foundation's work, this is so important for us, because at the Grand Rally and other big events that we've sponsored here at the NAMM Show, you know, we've had the Black Violin and String, we've had Canadian Brass, you know, representing that genre of music. And last year we had the three tenors, these wonderful young U.S.-based, New York-based tenors that were here, and they just knocked our socks off. And this year, we're having choral music. So, you know, it's been very important that we exhibit and we are very deliberate about embracing all aspects of music. You know, we had a wonderful violinist from the L.A., Robert Gupta, was with us from the L.A. Phil. On Sunday morning, we were sitting there listening to the Bach Chaconne. You know, so we were, and tonight and Saturday night, we're doing Room Full of Pianos, which is multiple hands-on piano festival, really. They're doing Carnival of the Animals for 15 pianists.
Oh, my God.
So come, it's at 5:30.
Okay.
So, you know, it's just so important for us that we're communicating to the world that all these genres are important. These experiences, wherever you decide to land in music, it's a validated experience.
Yeah, no question.
Yeah.
No question. And also great. That music doesn't need to be a profession. Of course, it's beautiful if you can turn it into your career, if that's what you want to do. But also just to have it in your life.
Right.
It's transformative, I think. It makes better people.
So speaking about transformative, we have to talk a little bit about what helped transform your career, right? Mm-hmm. Which was the virtual choir creation.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you were committed to choral music, you were writing, but then this idea really took you up onto another level of visibility. Am I correct about
that? I guess
so.
It was, I couldn't have expected it when it happened. So I had been, for nearly 10 years, working as a professional composer and conducting choirs and traveling and writing choral music. And then this virtual choir, I just had a simple idea to put these voices together and see what would happen.
Did you see something on the internet that gave you the idea of, like, you were seeing, I mean, we used to think that Skype was so cool, right? You could talk to somebody, and then you realize, oh, guess what? You can have 9 people on it, and they all have their little screens. I mean, did something happen
that there was a lot in the air. There were people starting to combine things online. YouTube was relatively new at the time, I think 3 or 4 years, and so people were just starting. So I remember seeing a few things, not like a virtual choir, but just thinking, oh, you could do this and you could do that. But it was this one video by this young woman, Britlin Losey. She sent me a fan video, and in it, she was singing the soprano line "To Sleep," this piece of mine that I knew. And the only idea I had, because I tried this before with other things, was if I could just get them singing at the same tempo.
It's synchronicity.
That's it. You just start the video at the same time, and then it will just roll out. It's a very simple idea.
Because tempo is tempo. We have that in music already.
That's right. And if they're singing in the same key.
We have that.
That's it. Then it would have to work, right? It would have to just, at the very least, everybody would more or less be moving around the same time. What I wasn't expecting was how musical it turned out to be. I thought it would really be a disaster, you know, how difficult it is to follow and to, I tried to give as much crescendo and decrescendo in my gestures before anybody had sung. But then the strangest thing, when the voices were all brought together, everybody crescendoed at the right time or decrescendoed. And by the right time, I don't mean exactly at the right time. That's one of the beautiful things about choral music is singers, all the rough edges get smoothed out.
Well, they play off of each other.
Yeah, but in this way, they can't play off each other.
Yes, they're all hooked in like we are.
Yeah, so they're only alone. That's what I thought wouldn't work. And so, but somehow the aggregate of all the people, and I get very spiritual about it. I think that it has as much to do with a technical and musical exploration as it does with an intentional phenomenon. That somehow, as long as the intention is pure, that each singer really invests and is giving, then somehow the aggregate of all that intention, it creates something kind of magical.
Yeah.
And I remember the first time I got the video back after it had been edited and I looked at it, I got real tears in my eyes. I couldn't believe not only that it was musical, but just the poetry of all these isolated faces from all over the world now suddenly making something larger than themselves.
So let's just go back to the moment of actually creating it. Were they all, just to kind of fill in my gap of knowledge, were they all singing live with you?
No. So
they were all recording separately.
Yeah. So they're all sitting in their dorm rooms or their living rooms.
So there was no aggregate moment.
Nothing.
They all were uploading in their time. And then you got the individual files, quote unquote.
That's right.
Oh,
it was such a leap of faith. Can you imagine for the singers?
You have to sit No. For you, it's a leap of faith. And your editor, it's the combination of it all.
This young man named Scott Haynes, who was the first, the one to do the very first virtual choir, it took him months. And he really did such a beautiful job getting all of those voices together. But I always think it's a leap of faith also for the singers, because your part on its own isn't so interesting. And it's also difficult. The kind of music I write asks for long phrases. It's hard to breathe. You have no one to really tune with. And so you're just watching my little conductor video on the screen. And you finish this thing, 5 minutes of choral music, and then you just upload it and say, well, I hope that works. I have no idea what I just did.
So the cue is what you're cueing them with, the visual.
They're watching me. That's
and they probably have experienced your music in other ways, or they're, you know, they're an Eric Whitaker groupie, and right, of which we know we have many, right?
Sometimes, but then, you know.
But it's cool that you can individualize it for them, right?
Yeah,
and
ideally.
And yet they're part of a really large experience.
I think that's it. A lot of the singers say they feel like it's an individual experience, a strange one, but we're together. And then 3 or 4 months later, when the video is finished, they look and say, oh my God, look what I'm a part of.
So how many of these have you done? Virtual Choir 1, Virtual Choir 2?
3, 4, 5.
We just finished five,
which is Deep Field.
And that's the one. Oh, yeah. Okay. I've seen that one.
That's with the Hubble telescope. That's our most ambitious to date. But then aside from that, we've also done 3 other ones. We did a virtual children's youth choir for UNICEF to open the Commonwealth Games. We did one for Disneyland, a piece called Glow, that played on the waters, the dancing waters that they have during winter. So, yeah, I guess we've done 8 virtual choir projects now in total.
And you still like them.
Next question, please.
It's a big project.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing that you've birthed into the world, you know. Anyone that experiences just through little computer speakers and then you put on the headsets and you start, you know, so I got to really hear this the way I need to. And then you see... It's very compelling. You wonder, so how did this happen? And then you see all the faces of what people are, you know, they're uploading them singing, and you see the ones with the buildings, and the buildings, you go down cityscapes.
We had to make a city. There were so many people.
And people are looking out from buildings, and you just kind of go, it has a deep feeling.
Thank
the whole
you.
Thing.
Thank you. I
the
think so too.
It's a very deep feeling.
I feel that. I joke about how much of a pain it is. And actually, I would be remiss if I didn't mention Claire Long and Meg Davies, because with the two of them do all the heavy lifting for these virtual choirs.
Yeah.
From production to organization to managing the web, which is its own thing now. We've got a dedicated web server to collect all of these things. And to, so without the two of them.
And technology, that the technology is there to support. Right? I mean, that the infrastructure, if that's not there, then you can't get to that creation.
It's amazing to think that 10 years ago, we couldn't have done something
No one
like this.
Would have seen this.
And it really makes you wonder what we'll be doing in 10 years.
Yes, that's, and we'll talk about that in another podcast, maybe. Because we need to go up there to find out, up to the, check to the, on the Hubble.
I keep telling them at NASA, when I was working with NASA, I kept saying, I need to get into space so that I can be inspired to write
a piece. We're going to talk about Hubble in a minute. Okay. But always on Docking Up Music Education, we have to do a little bit of origin stories, okay? Mm. In terms of what was your first music learning experience, your first instrument, you know, just with the teachers of influence that came along. We know you're a Juilliard graduate or...
Eventually, yeah. I was just one of those natural kid musicians, you know, that apparently there's lots of stories of me dancing endlessly, just dancing and dancing to whatever would happen. And I didn't have much exposure at all to classical music. I do have a memory of my grandmother putting on some Bach. They're probably like inventions or something played on a keyboard. And it's just making me crazy and running around. I was probably 2 or 3 years old. And my parents tried to give me piano lessons several times through my youth, and they just didn't stick. I hated reading music. And I didn't like to practice. But at the same time, I was in my room every day writing songs. And eventually I started collecting synthesizers and drum machines. And I was in a pop band, a rock band.
So you got right into the electronic keyboards.
Yeah, exactly.
Right to that technology early.
Yeah, and I loved it. That came from my love of computers. I was more of a computer geek first. So this was the mid-80s. And there were computers like the Commodore 64 that I learned to program. And I could program in BASIC, the BASIC language. And so the extension of music and computer music, that made me crazy. I had played trumpet in marching band for a couple of years.
Well, that's not bad.
But only by ear.
Yeah.
And
you just couldn't crack that code. It's so interesting.
The reading.
I mean, you could crack computer code, but the symbolism of music just didn't hit.
Yeah, and you know, it is so funny because I'm composing a piece right now, and you'd think after all this time, and I have my master's degree from Juilliard now, you'd think that this would be like second nature to me, reading music. And still, I struggle with it. I think because I learned music intuitively and didn't put names to it. Even now, if I think, say a chord progression like 5-7-1, right? I know what that is now. I can internalize it. I know all the technical aspects of it. But when I really think about it, there's an internal language that is
kind of intuitive to where you really, how you really want to.
Yeah, it's emotional.
Experience it
emotionally. And so for me to sort of bring myself down from the clouds and write down, I just find it so painstaking to put on paper what is in my head and in my heart. I know a lot of composers struggle with this, but because I came to it so late, I think I don't really have the super fast facility with it.
Yeah, but I it's also, you're speaking of it as if it's a deficit in some ways. And, you know, because it's not part of the traditional sort of expectation of advanced training and all of that. But I also think that you're opening up a discussion that could go on and on and on, that it's also another musical asset. That the fact that you, I mean, look at our jazz greats.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the whole tradition of coming, you know, going way back to its primary roots. And you look at, you spend a day or two in New Orleans, it's completely different there. I mean, there's a completely different music education
truly
thing happening there that comes through the, you know, the senses of the ear. And, you know, it grabbed you either way. And the fact that the tool for it is just different.
No, you're absolutely right.
The tool for it is just, and now you have all this, you know, all this you can hear and you can translate onto a computer and a keyboard linked into software notation, and then you can edit that.
Yes, of course.
Right?
Of
course. I mean, it's the tools have caught up, right?
Somewhat. I mean, first I would say, yes, it's absolutely, in some ways it's a strength. I can look back and say the fact that I wasn't trained classically, I ended up, I think, making decisions and making mistakes in my composition that I simply wouldn't have if I had known what I was doing. And those,
quote unquote,
you're right. No, but they actually ended up being surprising and interesting. Right. But that being said, there's a facility that, I look at Bach or Prokofiev, or I was talking to my fiance just the other night about The Love of Three Oranges, which is 3.5 hours long. And just writing an opera like this, I think he wrote it in 6 or 8 months, just the sheer magnitude of music to write down, it boggles my mind.
And you think Mozart too. And yet those were very structural composers at the same time. You know, they were working very formulaic.
That's true.
ABA. Coda.
And the forms help. Right. But then you see how fast and the facility they have where
internal ear there. Yeah. But I think you've turned out pretty good, though, even though you can't read music.
I can read okay.
I mean, we're not recommending it for every kid who wants to be a musician, right? It is a good thing to be able to do, but at the same time, let's remember where music comes from. It's
absolutely
a deep auditory experience.
But I will tell you, so I've got a 13-year-old boy who's playing bass now, and he's got a wicked ear, way better than mine. He's got such a great ear, but I work with him every day on reading music, mm-hmm. because ultimately, I think it can be a tool. I think for the long time, I thought it would somehow shut down my ear. But actually, I think they can really go well together. So I'm hoping that in the next couple of years, he'll be reading the way you would read a magazine.
Yeah, and there's nothing, as a classically trained flutist, you know, I can still open a score and I can hear it in my head.
Yeah, like this, right?
Yeah. Because it was those hours and hours and hours of ear training and sight reading and, you know, and then it becomes an internal audiation, you know, just because, the section, you know, and that's not very good, so do that.
Yeah, like reading a book.
Right, that's right. It. I mean, it's become kind of a wonderful sort of pastime because I still go back to the classical music scores and I listen to them and I check out a score from that. I just love studying a score, you know.
See that?
Go figure. I mean,
it's Mary, beautiful.
Don't you have other things to do with your time? Right? You know, I mean, that's some of us musicians reveal our secrets in a place like this. So anyway, NAM show. So if we were to give you a new middle name, I think it would be Eric Hubble Whitaker. So what happened to you? You went off the deep end into a deep field called the Hubble spacecraft.
That's good.
The telescope. Tell us what happened to you.
Well, I have been space nerd since I can remember. Like 9 or 10 years old, I had a first telescope at 10, I think, and I was and remain truly obsessed by space, by astrophysics, by the.
It was parallel to your musical life.
Yeah.
I'm hearing that. It was probably even a tension for which should I be more interested in.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think what happened to me is I realized at some point I just don't have the brain to be an astrophysicist. I wish that I did, but I think I've got more of a musician's brain than astrophysics, but I still remain an armchair astrophysicist. But the Hubble telescope, I've been enamored with the project since they first announced it. This is way before they launched it.
So you just follow. It was a following. You were following it and reading everything that came around about it. And,
exactly.
Right.
And when it launched, and when they first sent back this image, this deep field image, which at the time they pointed the telescope to a completely blank area of the sky. So there was, to earthbound telescopes, there was literally nothing there. Can you imagine? It's just black and the tiniest sliver of the sky. And they left the exposure open for over 11 days, something like 350 separate exposures. And when they finally got that data back and they looked, there were over 3,000 galaxies, right? Not stars, but galaxy. Each one of those galaxies representing hundreds of billions, if not trillions of stars in this tiny sliver of the sky. And to me, it's the most important image in human history. It shows us for the first time that, I mean, truly how important possibly large our universe is. Mm-hmm. So since that time, I think somewhere in the back of my mind, I was thinking, I want to express this musically. Somehow I want to express it. And then it was a long journey to doing that. And then I finally wrote a piece for orchestra and for smartphone apps and for choir, and then added the virtual choir to it. So now there's voices from 123 countries singing on the top of it and this big film with it.
The film, and we're seeing the film tomorrow.
That's
we have an encore to the Grand Rally, and we'll be showing Deep Field.
Yeah, which is very humbling to me. That
and you've done the soundtrack for the film, right?
And basically, it's the opposite. Like I wrote the piece, and then they made a movie to the piece.
That's right.
So, and it's been a great joy for me to not only work on this project in the film, but now I think
in partnership with NASA,
and the Space Telescope Science Institute. And I've been to Kennedy Space Center, I think, 4 times now, and I've met several astronauts and lots of people who worked on the Hubble team and the space shuttle team. And my inner nerd is just, you know.
And somewhere out there, there's someone saying, thank God, Eric, help them find us. Eric, thank you. Through music, we've been found.
I wonder if that's
it. I mean, it's beyond words kind of inspiring, right? That our commitment to technology and machines and that we got the thing up there and that we pointed it in a direction and that we were able to see that.
And that it works. It's unbelievable.
And we were able to see that. And then it comes to us and we go, we get to see that.
Yes.
What does that mean?
One of the things that I was struck by when I was there at NASA and spending all that time with these people is that the scientists and the engineers who work on these things are very, very much like artists. There's a purity to what they do. They're only interested in the truth, in making something bigger than they made yesterday or better than they made yesterday. And the reason we climbed Mount Everest is because it was there. There's a purity to it.
So,
I really see them like artists just with a different set of skills.
That, you know, that the beauty of that engineer who just keeps striving for a finer edge, you know,
yes,
more symmetry, more. Well, we can't wait to have that experience. You know, we'll be singing at the Grand Rally in the morning. We'll have a little break and then bring up the film and let people experience that. So that's really, really great.
Thank you.
Couple of final questions, including the last one was kind of what's next for you, what other projects? But the one before that is when I hear your music, it's a sonic quality, right? It's loaded with a lot of nuance and a lot of layers. So the question to you is that in your process of composing, is it the sound that ignites you first? Are you stretching and reaching for a sound? Or are you reflecting off of an experience that elicits a sound? You know, it's just kind of, it's kind of that composer's chicken or egg question. Where does the impetus for the movement of the composition sort of, or is it, and I've left you puzzled.
No, I'm really thinking about it. It's a great question. I'm in the middle
it's
of writing.
It's a composer's question. I don't get to ask it very often.
Composers don't get asked it very often.
Right.
I'm in the middle of writing a piece called The Sacred Veil, and actually it'll premiere in 3 weeks, but I'm still writing it. And it's a difficult piece. It's my best friend, Charles Anthony Silvestri, lost his wife to ovarian cancer 12 years ago. And for the first time, he's felt that he's ready to write about it. So that's what we've been writing, this long piece. It's a 70-minute work with lots of different movements. And when you asked the question, I thought, what is the impetus? And I realized there are some composers that it seems to me, say Bach, for instance, who just, they revel in the relationship between the notes.
He was a very mathematical composer.
I guess so,
He was. I mean, you analyze the inventions and it's Baroque retrograde. I mean, he was a very mathematical composer.
And it's beautiful, right?
Like
he comes up with
it's symmetry extraordinary harmonic, melodic symmetry. Yes.
That's it.
Yeah.
But in a way, it's an abstraction that exists perfectly in its own little... it's got its own logic. I have to admit, I can't write music without a fundamental emotion connected to it.
Okay.
So I can noodle at the piano and I can come up with a thing and a thing and a thing, but for it to work, for it to actually come out of my body, it has to have meaning.
It connects.
Yeah, deep spiritual, emotional meaning, every single note. And so
that's what I'm hearing, I think, in your music. But then I ask the question, well, is it sound that's leading? Is it that the sound palette? I guess that's all part of the emotion. The emotion's pushing you to that selection.
Usually, right? Exactly. What happens is this is what made me think of The Sacred Veil, that I'm looking for a very specific emotional quality, say a melancholy mixed with a tinge of hope, mixed with a weariness, let's say, super specific. And then I'll be at the piano or I'll be thinking or writing things down, trying things. And then suddenly, just a few notes.
You find it.
Oh, yeah.
Somehow, or it finds you.
Yeah, that's it. And somehow that thing equals that emotion. And if I really get it right, then my experience has been the listener feels the same thing. There's an emotional communication that's happening through the music somehow. Mm-hmm. It's the only way I know how to compose. The challenge for me is that I don't know how to manufacture it without actually feeling it.
Yeah, and then what if it does come in time for the premiere?
Yeah, exactly.
It's truly authentic.
It never comes in time for the premiere. Right. So it's about wrestling it out of the... I'm making it sound very dramatic.
I think it is kind of... I mean, we're all, on the human level, it's your work and it's ready. It's getting ready for prime time. And that's also why all composers in every era have gone back to rework and revise their compositions,
yes.
Right? I hope you have the confidence and courage to do that.
No, thank you. I only laugh because I keep thinking of the premiere as less the premiere and more like the first draft.
Yeah, so. I think that's totally reasonable. I hope you feel that way.
Thank you.
Yeah. It is. I mean, I think creation is work in progress too.
It's really true. It's just, it's a funny thing to do it in front of a paying audience.
Yeah.
But
they would otherwise not even have that experience at all.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
So let it go.
Okay.
Let it go, Eric Whitaker.
Let it go.
just let the music go already.
I'm trying.
Okay, so after this pressure cooker that you're in to get this big work done, it sounds beautiful.
Thank you.
Where's it going to be premiered?
Los Angeles Master Chorale.
Oh,
Disney
beautiful.
Hall here in L.A. So, 3 weeks.
Okay. Now, let's be sure we get brass tacks down. How can people follow you? Where do they know where your work is being played? How do they sign up for the fan base? Where do we go?
So, I'm on Instagram and Twitter and Facebook. And
just Eric Whitaker?
Eric Whitaker on all of them.
Yeah.
And to sign up for the virtual choir, if someone wants to sing, they can just go to my website. They put in their name, and then we'll send them all the information they need for the next one. I should also for the people who are interested, that it's only me on social media. I don't let anybody post on my behalf. So if someone likes their comment or responds to them, it's always me.
Okay.
I try to remain as active as possible.
You're bold. I guess when you need a break from getting compositions to come out, then you go check Instagram.
I'll tell you, right? It's more than the break. I actually, I find composing, the act of composing, very lonely.
Oh, yeah.
You're in this room and you just have no one.
You're trying to grind it out. Yeah.
Yeah. So sometimes I'll write, like I'll post on Facebook, I'll put a little viola line and say, violists of the world, is this well-written or is this possible?
I love that. That's so cool.
And it's the best because then I'll get 200 responses back. And so not only am I getting the answer, but I feel less lonely.
I can never go up here and do that.
Yeah. They're like, you might want to try
don't
this.
Write,
you
right,
can do
right,
it.
Right.
Yeah. And it's, But I feel like we're all in it together in a way.
Oh, that is terrific. Yeah. That's really great. And your dates and the composition dates and all the places where you are on your website too.
Exactly.
So people can meet up with you and connect. And
Yeah.
Okay.
All that stuff is there.
And all the music on iTunes and everything.
Yeah. iTunes, Spotify, all the streaming services. I've got a couple of pieces out on vinyl, if there's any vinyl nuts out there.
Oh, there are.
And,
that we know.
And I announced this stuff all over the place.
That's great. Mostly LA-based and moving around a lot?
Moving around a lot, actually. Yeah. So the day after the Sacred Veil premiere, I'll go to Brussels to conduct a concert with the Brussels Phil. At some point in the spring, I'm in Ohio, then I'm in New York, then I'm in Budapest, then I'm in Switzerland. It's just musicians, you just go where the work is.
And today, he's at the NAMM show.
I wouldn't want to be anywhere
else. And tomorrow
else.
He's at the Grand Rally.
The Grand Rally.
The Grand Choir, Mass Choir.
It's going to be fun. It sounded great today during rehearsal.
It's just going to be a highlight. We can't wait.
Thank you.
So thank you so much for being here. So now should we do the weather?
Yeah. Oh, should
we do the weather? Should we do where to take the family this weekend?
Yeah.
No.
Take them here. The weather outside. I really feel terrible for anybody who's watching this from the East Coast.
Yeah, we're really lucky to have the perfect NAMM show weather here in Anaheim.
It's like 76 degrees
outside.
It's
in the mid-70s. Sorry.
Oh,
sorry, all of you
beautiful.
In North Dakota. But if you are in North Dakota or wherever you are, thank you so much for being part of Facebook Live and our broadcast here from the NAMM show with the talented multi-talented. The music just pours out of him. Composer, conductor, Eric Whitaker. So thank you so much for being part of us here at the NAMM show and talking up music education, a podcast of the NAMM Foundation.
Talking Up Music Education is a podcast created by the NAMM Foundation. To learn more about how you can support music education in your community or how you can be part of the work of the NAMM Foundation, visit our website, www.namfoundation.org, or join us on Facebook at facebook.com/NAMM Foundation. You can also follow Mary on Twitter at Mary L. Nam. That's Mary L. N. A. M. M.